From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. For 4 months now, we've been on a roller coaster of uncertainty. It's a funny thing as a broadcaster, because while we're tasked with covering the roller coaster, we're also experiencing it in real time. Last week on the show, we painted a picture of an industry on the precipice of change or failure of the unknown. This week, we're focusing our lens on what happens when you reach the precipice and you dodge the free fall. You hustle, you scramble. In other words, you pivot. Almost all of the stories you'll hear on today's show are about this word, pivot, which until a few months ago was a verb I associated mostly with basketball. Now, in the backdrop of the pandemic, it's become a noun, as in, what's your pivot? Let me give you an example. Do you remember those days of waiting to log onto a reservation system so you could grab a coveted table months in advance? One of those systems is Talk, co-founded by Nick Kokonis of the Alinea Group in Chicago. As the pandemic forced restaurants to pivot and become marketplaces and takeout-only establishments, Nick reacted by pivoting his service to be of better use to restaurants during lockdown. Hi, Nick.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
You know, moving day to day.
Yeah, that's what this is all about, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, none of us want to be here, but doing nothing is not an option. So we're trying to do the best we can with everything.
What's the current state of dining in Chicago?
At the moment, as of today, indoor dining is fragile. We have about 25% capacity that we're allowed. All of the bars, however, were shut a few days ago, reshut. Patios are allowed with proper spacing. And carryout is allowed. And that's it. And it feels fragile at the moment.
When did you realize that you'd have to respond to a different reality, not just with Alinea, but with Talk?
I can tell you exactly when that is. It was March 6th. About a week earlier, I was looking at the reservations in Hong Kong, and they had gone from being largely sold out for about the 20 or 30 restaurants that are on Talk in Hong Kong to completely zero, no reservations at all. And then on March 6th, I started seeing that some of the West Coast, Pacific Northwest areas had started to see declines in reservations and increases in cancellations, coinciding roughly to the unfortunate incident in Seattle with the nursing home that had a bunch of COVID cases. And that was the moment I realized, you know, it happened in Italy, it happened in China and Hong Kong, it's starting to happen here. And so we very rapidly looked to, for my own restaurants and for Talk, to figure out the best ways to pivot, to try to keep people employed and trying to keep feed people as well.
In a way, it's sort of wonderful that you are not only the head of Talk, but that you're a restaurateur, because it's like you have this inside knowledge of what restaurants needed to do, and then you had to figure out a way to reinforce that with Talk.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, I was staring down the barrel of both the restaurants that I own with Grant Achatz and realizing that, you know, on the best case scenario, all of the tourists weren't going to be able to come to Chicago. No one's going to fly in. And that's 40 or 50% of our business in the summer. And that would be enough to obviously have a severe impact on the restaurants. And then the worst case, of course, was what happened, which is that, you know, we would need to close entirely. And on the Talk side, we also realized that all the reservations would go to zero in any of the cities that are affected. So we recognized very quickly that we would have to move to carryout operations. It would be the only option. And I pulled in our team and we put in protocols for safety. I consulted with some doctors in Chicago at the University of Chicago that I know. And we instituted, before we were mandated to close, we instituted masks and gloves and hourly hand washing and temp checks at their recommendation. And then when the governor mandated that, you know, the restaurants close in Illinois, we kind of went, okay, plan five. And we furloughed everybody immediately. We paid every one of our employees $1,000 stipend. And then we set about trying to figure out how fast we could hire everyone back. So that Friday, 4 days later, we did 500 meals out of Alinea. By the following Monday, we were doing 750 a night and had about 40% of our staff back. And over the course of the next month, we slowly reopened each of our restaurants for carryout, tried to come up with innovative ways of doing it. And at the same time, we built all of the tools in Tock that restaurants would need that were very different than third-party delivery apps, which often charge 20 to 30% and are really built just as supplemental income for restaurants. As well, a lot of the restaurants on Tock are more elevated. There are places like Ennaka or, you know, Republic in Los Angeles or Atelier Crenn in San Francisco, Canlis in Seattle. So we recognized that these restaurants were going to do innovative, interesting opportunities to do, you know, carryout cuisine that was a new kind, really. And so we started building the carryout tools like two-way text messaging, mapping, kitchen inventory on the data structures that we already had in Tock. And then, of course, the Tock users had access to their customers in the ways that they don't on OpenTable or Resy. And so that combination, in the past 12 weeks, we've added over 2,000 new restaurants around the country using Tock for Tock to Go. And while they started using that, we started building Tock 20, which is all of the things that you need to reopen in 2020, ranging from contactless ordering and payment to reconfiguration of tables that plays like a video game and a whole host of other features to try to get restaurants up and running again.
I'm so curious about the rapid rise of to-go at the restaurants when you first pivoted to that. Did Grant ever try to recreate the Alinea experience as takeout, or did everyone pretty much recognize immediately that the options offered would have to be different?
Yeah, I mean, I pulled Grant aside and said, this is going to be a catastrophe. Like, I think I'm right, and we need to do carryout food that costs $35. And I think he'll be the first to admit that he looked at me and thought, I lost my mind. Like, you know, a lot of our staff thought I was being alarmist.
Just for some bit of context, how much would a regular meal at Alinea cost?
Well, Alinea is a Michelin 3-star restaurant. You're going to have a 3 to 4 hour meal and with wine and everything, about $350 a person. So, you know, you can either do 100 people at $350, or you can do 350 people at $100, or you could do 1,000 people at $35 and you have the same business. And that was the math I was doing in the back of the envelope in my head. And my goal was just to get to 500 people at $35. And so what happened was I said, you know, it was March, it was still cold in Chicago. And I said, like, look, let's do a 3-course comfort meal. Like, you know, a short rib beef Wellington is what Grant came up with, you know, a salad and a dessert. And then they can add on a bottle of wine or something if they'd like. And the first day that we put it up, the first 3 days sold out at 500 each in a matter of like an hour. And by the third day, Grant was like, oh, this is doable. Let's make it 750. A week later, we were doing 1,250 meals a night out of Alinea. And we had built on the back end in Tock the ability to book those in time windows of 15 minutes apiece so that you didn't have 400 cars pull up in front all at once. And it really worked. You know, during that time in this crisis, people were hungry for emotional connection with the restaurants. They were tired of cooking in. And this was a very safe way in cities that weren't New York City, where, you know, people have automobiles in Cleveland and Chicago and Los Angeles, San Francisco, and you can drive places. It was a very safe way to pick up food. You know, you have two-way text messaging. We just pop the trunk. We put the meal in. And then on May 4th, which was our 15th anniversary, Grant finally said, okay, we've done 3 different comfort, you know, foods. We're going to do like a 5-course Alinea meal to go for our 15th anniversary. And those were really elaborate, $50 a piece. And we were sold 1,250 a night for 3 weeks.
The thing that you managed to do, which I find so interesting, is you lost all those tourists, but you must have gotten a huge number of people who the regular Alinea was out of reach for them.
1,000% true. Yeah. I mean, the part that was the most heartwarming about the whole thing is that on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter, people were reaching out to me and to the restaurant every night with pictures of their family doing the famous matte plate dessert at home. So we gave them, you know, we gave them a piece of like acetate, you know, plastic, and they were doing the painted dessert on the table at night. And it was really a way during this very scary early time in the COVID crisis to have a little bit of joy and spread a little bit of joy for all these families. And we served about 32,000 meals in the month of May out of Alinea, and all within, you know, 20 miles of Chicago, with a couple of exceptions of some crazy college kids that drove from New York overnight just to pick up a meal.
During the process of reconfiguring Talk and developing all the tools, did some restaurants that were not previously Talk restaurants sort of come in and say what they needed? Did you reach out to a wider group to ask what kind of tools they were most hungry for?
We certainly did. We talked to the existing clients. But really, by the time that the restaurants in many places understood that they suddenly needed to do this, we had 80% of it built because of Canlis. And, you know, it kind of went across the country in a wave, right? And so, you know, I think a lot of restaurants thought, oh, well, we're going to be closed for 2 weeks and then we'll reopen. And when that reality after the 2 weeks happened and they couldn't reopen, that's when the restaurants started reaching out. We had in the month of April, over 2,800 restaurants from around the world reach out to us organically, like, you know, just go to our website, type in their information. And, you know, we were signing up 50 to 100 new restaurants every single day for months, still are.
Talk does not handle delivery drivers. What was your rationale in leaving that up to the restaurants?
Well, it's really a cost structure. You know, if you take 20 or 30% of the revenue away from the restaurant, this is not a viable option to save your business. So Talk charges a flat 3%. The secondary thing is that all of these employees, these front of house employees that are not really needed, you know, during a closure, could be used as delivery folks from within the restaurant so that they get employed. And then in cities that really needed the delivery, where people didn't have the cars, we negotiated with the third party delivery apps to do a fixed fee of between $5 and $7 per delivery flat. That gets charged to the consumer. So if the consumer doesn't want to pick it up, the restaurant can offer delivery if they choose, but it doesn't, you know, like if there's a $200 carryout order on Talk, we charge $6 for that. A delivery app might charge $60. So charging the consumer the equivalent of a cab ride or maybe even a little bit less to get it delivered if they so choose is great. And people are able to tip the driver, and so it works out well for the drivers as well.
Do you envision the business you're in going back to the same normal as pre-pandemic?
You know, I'm an optimist by nature. And if you look back through the history of humanity, unfortunately, this has happened, you know, every 50 to 100 years, going back as far as we look. So I do know that at some point in the future, we will be able to intermingle with each other more safely than we can now. I hope that there are positive changes that come of this. I certainly think elevated carryout is a wonderful thing. I think that tipping and other practices in the United States that are antiquated and kind of a remnant of the past go away, while hospitality employees need to be treated like the professionals they are in terms of pay, in terms of benefits. So I think that, you know, through this hardship, there's a lot of lessons being learned about how to run the industry, how to treat the employees that make us all so happy.
Thank you so much, Nick.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure being here.
That's Nick Kokonis. He's the co-owner of the Alinea Group and co-founder of Talk. We've been discussing how he's enhancing the reservation system to assist restaurants with delivery, pickup, and contactless payment. Originally, when we planned to show around this idea of the pivot, I knew I wanted to reach out to David Wilcox. His restaurant, Hail Mary, in Atwater Village is known for their pizza, but in the industry, it's also becoming known as a place for innovative solutions to systemic problems. David's pivot is actually a series of pivots that all started in 2018 when his restaurant, Journeyman, was $150,000 in debt, and he had one shot at a Hail Mary to save it. Hi, David.
Hello, Evan.
So take us back to Journeyman. You were open for about a year before you pivoted to Hail Mary. What was the intention that you had set for yourself when you originally opened Journeyman in 2017?
The real drive behind Journeyman was to, in my entire time in and out of the restaurant industry over now 26 years, was to ask questions regarding what myself as other and others have talked about for a long time, which is just kind of this culture of the industry, the overworking, the underpaid, the lack of accountability, just kind of everything. We wanted to ask questions regarding it. We didn't necessarily have answers. We just wanted to ask questions that hopefully would help us seek some answers. And that was really what we set out to do with Journeyman originally, was to do that.
So tell us about that pivot, or where you were with Journeyman when you realized that all your intentions would come to nothing if you couldn't figure out a way to stay open.
Yeah, I mean, all the good intentions in the world don't run a successful business, right? To be honest, truthfully, I felt like an ostrich with my head in the ground for the last 6 months of Journeyman. I had bit off more than I could chew. We never really figured out what Journeyman really was meant to be. It was overly ambitious, would be an easy descriptor. And one day, just to look at the bank account and go, wow, we're done. Like, we don't have any money. That's it. And at one point, honestly considered throwing in the towel. And it was my teenage son, who he's now going on 19, but at the time, you know, maybe 16, 17. He said, so what, that's it? You're just going to give up? And... you know, it's fair like that, you know. I mean, failure is one thing, but something we've talked about since he was little was the whole point of failure is to learn.
And what was the staff, your collaborators in Journeyman, what were their thoughts about this Hail Mary pivot, this pivot to pizza after what they had been making on the plates?
So I remember the meeting that I had with everyone, and we sat outside and I explained to them what was going on very openly and you know, took ownership of my failures and said, nonetheless, what I'm going to do is put some pizzas in the oven and, you know, at least see what we can do. And I said, I can't make any promises that any of this is going to work, but I'm willing to give it a shot. And if any of you are interested in doing so with me, this is what we'll do. And everybody wanted to help, but the key... five other members, it was six of us total, that stayed. They stayed with the intention of they too had seen everything that had happened with Journeyman and they wanted to be a part of that. You know, we spoke openly during Journeyman about, like, we had very open meetings about the business and how to do things, but, you know, none of it was all talk. This idea of having kind of a workers collective, having equity in the company, profit sharing, all these things, they were just talk. There was no ability to make that true or right with Journeyman. And with Hail Mary, it was, you know, through this process of sticking it out that they all kind of saw that we could actually achieve that and get there together. And so we've remained open in our conversations. We have meetings about all of how we run the business and how we make choices together.
Do you think the fact that you pivoted to pizza ended up being a blessing when the pandemic hit?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, it's takeout, right? It's takeout and delivery, and that's what's working right now. And, you know, we've had some little changes we've made, like we decided to let go of delivery apps, and there was a little bit of a scare there for a moment, like, oh, will that have an effect? And It did for maybe a week, and then our sales kind of rebounded.
So let's talk about this decision to forgo delivery apps. We've heard so much about how they charge as much as 30%, which is just a non-starter on such a low margin business to begin with. So who picked up that job of delivering food to people?
I have a friend from within the industry. She worked at another place, a bar actually. And at some point, the dialogue just kind of sparked up. And I knew that she lived with her sister. And I said, well, if you're willing to, you know, quarantine for 2 weeks. And we just decided to go for it. We explored insurance options. It wasn't as out of reach as I thought maybe it would be. And, you know, little by little, our delivery has started to make up for the delivery that we lost. And truthfully, most people, I mean, still a majority of our business comes from curbside pickup, but the delivery is growing little by little. And we're not in any, you know, for us, it's more about if it can pay for itself right now, we'll continue to grow it.
Okay, so let's talk about the we. Is this a co-op? Have you turned it over to the employees? What does financial equity look like at Hail Mary?
So we're kind of working through that together. We're setting up a profit share program for employees in general as we start to meet our expectations that we originally set as journeymen and return our money to our investors. And we're set up a little differently, I will say that too, than most places in terms of the way our investor pool is set up. But eventually, all of that investor equity will be available to the team. On top of that, we're working together to all get health insurance. That's one of the hardest things as a restaurant, as you know, most people know, is to achieve that. And so we've started to kind of budget for that as we move towards profitability. And then equity shares for founding type and managing type members. And that really kind of varies from person to person. And we're really just having a dialogue, you know, with everyone about what feels fair, what feels equitable, what feels right.
Do they know how much money you make?
Yeah. Yeah. We're open about all of that. I make less than a lot of them, actually.
Yes, I'm familiar with that paradigm. So you're still in a growth phase now.
Yeah.
What does the future look like to you?
Oh, boy. The best answer I would say is I don't know, but that leaves me open to what will come. Hail Mary is a decent-sized space. It's large enough that we could commissary into other locations that potentially would be takeout and delivery only, and we could kind of expand our reach. We know that we're working towards investing in a community garden program as our means to give back, and we're kind of defining what that looks like right now. The main thing is really just focusing on building a better business and us working together collectively to do that.
Well, I wish you the best. Thank you so much, David.
Oh, thank you, Evan, very much, and I appreciate you having me on the show.
That was David Wilcox of Hail Mary in Atwater Village. Coming up, what is a talented young cook to do when the restaurant they were working in closes? LA Times critic Bill Addison stops by to tell us about a handful of culinary upstarts who are building new businesses amidst the chaos of the pandemic.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. The ability to pivot is a skill you acquire pretty quickly in the restaurant world. People in hospitality have always been dancing as fast as they can just to keep up. And now that dance is for survival. A benefit for we eaters is that often small is really beautiful. LA Times restaurant critic Bill Addison recently focused on what he calls takeout upstarts. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Evan. Always so good to hear your voice.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've talked. It's just so great to hear your voice, too. How are you?
I'm well. I'm grateful to be well. And, you know, watching our city and our state start to shut back down. And for a moment there, my editors and I wondered if, as critics, Patricia Skarsgård and I might start turning our attention once again to eating in restaurants, and instead we're finding ourselves circling back, doubling down on takeout.
There you go. So this latest roundup, takeout upstarts, describe what you mean by that phrase.
I'm really talking about chefs and other food professionals who are taking it upon themselves to find ways to serve customers, to get their food or their sense of hospitality out into the world. People have been creating these opportunities mostly through social media and word of mouth. For someone like me, for a journalist, it's almost like a game to follow chefs on Instagram in particular and see who's friends of theirs they're shouting out, who might be selling banchan or elaborate multi-course meals that they're kind of just coming out with. Some of them are cooking from their homes. Some of them are cooking in ghost kitchens. Some are cooking in shared commercial kitchens. But there's this whole underground social media network of people serving food that is quite wonderful and really still giving us a sense of community for Los Angeles dining.
So let's hear about a few of them. Let's start with Brandoni Pepperoni.
Yes, Brandon Gray. I think that you know about Brandon Gray. He mentioned when I talked to him on the phone that you were one of his first customers. He is currently running the kitchen of Royce Burke's Secret Lasagna, which is a takeout restaurant that actually opened during the shutdown in the West Hollywood Gateway complex. So Burke asking Gray if he could cook an off-the-cuff pizza to bring to a friend. And that friend turned out to be Evan Kleiman. And at the same time, I didn't include this in the piece, but he mentioned to a friend that day, I'm just making a pizza. And the friend that he mentioned to was like, well, I want pizza from you. And sort of by the end of the day, he was like, is this my new calling? Am I now going to be making pizza for a living? And he's exceptionally good at it.
Okay, so I just have to say that I didn't realize I was a guinea pig. I thought he was making pizza. So, I mean, these days we have so many different kinds of pizza in this town. How would you describe this particular one?
It's a thin crust, almost crackery, covered with a sauce made from Bianco di Napoli tomatoes. And then he buys ingredients primarily from the Santa Monica Farmers Market. And he's making some really beautiful, interesting, very seasonal combinations.
So next, let's go to Bridgetown Roti.
Rashida Holmes was primarily catering and gearing up to open her own restaurant. She is of Bajan heritage. Her family's from Barbados. And she was specializing in rotis before the shutdown. And then she shifted to savory patties, the Caribbean style savory patties filled with things like oxtails with peppers and callaloo greens with crab and pork belly. And as of this week, she is moving her operations to Crafted Kitchen in downtown Los Angeles. That's a shared use space. And she's back to doing both patties and roti.
And we should say that a patty in this context is kind of like an empanada.
Yes, like a cross between an empanada and almost like a savory hand pie.
Right, right. And now the next one is Farm Direct.
It's two chefs, Scott Chacone and Tad Wayland. They're both freelance chefs. And they met on a job last year and realized they lived in the same Los Feliz apartment complex. They just started brainstorming about doing multi-course meals together. And they come up with a different menu every week. So I had one recently that featured pork cooked in achiote, with grilled squash and baby corn and guacamole and a whole bunch of other stuff. It was a real treat.
Next, a couple that we've heard about a lot lately, Deporis.
Oh, I love this pair, Danielle Bell and Pablo Osorio. They hosted a regular dinner series, first in New York and then here. And they were also at a couple area farmers markets serving things like ají de gallina, which is the creamy Peruvian chicken stew, one of my favorite Peruvian dishes, and her chicken and biscuits. They combined their heritages. He's from Peru. She is from Louisville, Kentucky. If Danielle makes biscuits, absolutely get them. They're incredible. And keep an eye out for Osorio is doing a menu around July 28th to commemorate Peru's Independence Day.
Exciting. Okay, next is Kemla. I'm really curious to try this one.
Yes. So Pert M was general manager of Bar Ama, and she and the sommelier next door at Orso Winston, these are both Joseph Centeno restaurants, were putting them their know-how together to do pop-ups called Kemla. M has a Cambodian background, and so she was putting together dishes that she would say that she's riffing on her heritage. It's not super traditional. It's things that she likes with ingredients that she likes. Maybe the crepe bansio with mushrooms, which is how she likes it, though that may not be super traditional. And so she just decided to start putting these out during the shutdown. She was doing menus, three courses, really quite affordable, $25, $30 a pop per person. And she started doing it every week now that interest has picked up. You can find her. You can find most everyone that I'm talking about on Instagram. So she's an easy one to find, and she'll deliver all over the metro area.
Next, we move to Orso Pasta.
These are alums led by Josh Bachwald of Rosso Blue. And so Rosso Blue makes some of the best pasta in Los Angeles. And so, you know, having learned under Rosso Blue chef Steve Sampson, this is going to be good. And it's really straightforward, but it's just fantastic, comforting, fresh pastas and sauces when you're really just wanting a different angle on something that probably all of us have been eating a lot of during the shutdown. So gnocchi, cavatelle, tagliatelle. His bolognese, I think, is exceptionally good. His cacio e pepe is also wonderful.
Well, thank you so much, Bill. I really enjoyed this group.
Thanks, Evan.
Bill Addison is a restaurant critic at the Los Angeles Times. We've been talking about his recent article on takeout upstarts. We've got a full list of all the people he just talked about on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Continuing the theme of takeout upstarts, Jillian Ferguson is at the Saturday Santa Monica Farmers Market talking to another chef who pivoted from high-end dining to chefed-up comfort food.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I'm at the market this week with Wen Bui, who is about 2 months into a new project called Ancom. Wen most recently was a sous chef at Rustic Canyon in Santa Monica. But at his new project, he offers a weekly home-style Vietnamese menu that's available for pickup in West LA. Hi, Wen.
Hey, Jillian.
So first, tell us about the name. What does it mean?
Ancom, directly translated, it means to eat rice. But really, it's about having a meal and having a meal with the family. I mean, whenever I hear it, for me, it's like really endearing because they like, it's not really a hello that people ask you when they see you. When I go to my family's house, they ask you, have you eaten yet? So, it's just really about nourishing each other.
That's great. And are you doing this a la carte or is it a set meal?
It's a la carte.
All right. And we're standing next to Kong Tao's booth. The herbs smell absolutely incredible right where we are. All the summer produce is coming in, and that means a ton of eggplant. And you have a very intriguing eggplant dish on your menu. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, it's called Gatim Noong. It's a charred eggplant marinated in fish sauce and finished with scallion oil. The eggplants get a really smoky flavor from getting charred either on the stove or on a grill. We do it over wood on a grill. It gets completely charred, and so the skin gets nice and crisp. And then you cut it in half and pull the flesh out, kind of keep it as whole and intact as possible. And then we marinate it in fish sauce for a lot of umami, and then finish with scallion oil for a lot of really good aroma.
And what kind of eggplant are you using?
I really like the Chinese eggplant for this one in particular. The Japanese one works really well too. I think the Japanese is a little creamier than I'd like. But I think any eggplant will really work. The bigger ones like the Italian and the American eggplants, they don't really roast well. By the time the outside's done, the inside's kind of not done. So, I prefer either the Japanese or the Chinese.
Okay, and those are the long, skinny ones, right?
Yeah, that's right. The Chinese ones have like a darker purple hue, and the Japanese ones are really dark. Kong's ones are almost black, and they look really good. They're perfect.
All right, and then walk us through how to char them properly, because if we don't have a grill, how would we do this over our stove?
I really like doing over, if you have a gas stove, just like line your stove with a little bit of foil because it's going to get a little messy, and then cut it, the eggplants, into the size that you like, put it directly on the stove, and then turn the fire on, and you want to get it like black. You should be able to pick it up and kind of tap at it, and it should feel a little crispy. It shouldn't be soft anymore. And that's the best way for it to separate, because if you don't cook it long enough, the skin doesn't separate from the flesh on the inside. It's like really hard to peel.
All right. And then you mentioned a fish sauce marinade. Is there anything that goes in with the fish sauce?
Yeah, it's fish sauce, sugar, lemon juice. I'm using Meyer lemons right now, and Thai chilies.
And how long do you let it marinate for?
It almost instantly marinates. I mean, I would wait at least like 60 seconds, but because the eggplant is like really soft, the marinade gets in there really quickly.
All right. Well, this sounds great. Where can people find you and your menu?
You can go to my Instagram, ancom, ancom.la, and we open up order forms every Sunday at noon.
All right. Great. Wen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jillian.
That was Wen Bui. His latest project is ancom. Kong Tao is the farmer who grows the eggplant that Wen is buying, and Kong and his family grow this incredible array of produce on their farm in Fresno and bring it down to Southern California markets each week. Hi, Kong.
Hi there.
It's great to see you here today. So let's talk about your eggplant. Can you tell us all the varieties that you grow and what qualities make each of them unique?
I think this year we have 9 varieties in. Each one has like a different skin, different texture, different seed content, and it just depends on what you're using it for. Like we have the American black bells and the Italian eggplant, which is a thicker skin. The eggplant holds better. So like if you're going to fry them or you want something that's going to hold better, you go with something like that. And then we have like a Japanese, Chinese, and a Filipino variety. Those are really tender, thin-skinned eggplants and quick cooking eggplants, but they fall apart if you try to cook them too long.
I see. Can you ever eat eggplants raw, or do you have to cook them?
Like, we grow a Thai eggplant, and that one, at home, we eat it raw most of the time.
Do you dress it?
No, like, it's more, we'll eat the Thai eggplant raw as, like, on a side. We'll have, like, a meat salad or something, like larb. And then Thai eggplant just goes really well with it.
So. To sort of scoop everything up.
Yep.
Oh, wow. Well, I would be remiss if we didn't talk about all the incredible other produce that's here on your table right now. Particularly the bitter melons, which are coming in. Can you describe what they are and what you've got today?
Yeah, it's bitter melon season. We started with the greens. We grow a crop indoor just to pick the greens, the tendrils. That's used like a spinach or so. That's actually our best-selling item of everything we grow. And then we grow on outside, we grow 3 varieties. We do a Taiwanese variety, a regular green variety, and then we do this tiny little this Indian variety, which is a really, really dark colored. The darker the color, the more bitter it is. So the Indian variety is very bitter. The Taiwanese is like a white color, so it's not as bitter.
And describe the texture of the flesh.
Texture-wise, like bitter melon, it's like eating like a cucumber, but it's a cucumber that's made to be cooked. You don't peel it. It doesn't have a skin or anything.
So is it technically a melon or is it a squash?
I'd say it's a squash gourd family.
Okay, what's your favorite way to eat them?
I grew up not liking it, but as I've gotten older, my mom has always, she'll take the bigger ones and she stuffs them with like pork, green onions, and then she'll steam them whole and we'll, you know, cut into them, eat them like that, eat them in slices.
Wow, I always love hearing what your mom is making for the family whenever I come to the market.
Come up for lunch sometime.
I'd love to. That was Kong Tao of Tao Family Farms. You can find him at the Tuesday Torrance, Saturday Santa Monica, and Sunday Hollywood Farmers Markets. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
Have you seen the community fridges that are popping up around Los Angeles? In a minute, we talk to two organizers about what they are and how they work. Stay with us. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. You may have seen community libraries around your neighborhood, those little cabinets for your old paperbacks that passersby can grab. But have you seen a community refrigerator? With enough food to go around, reasons for continued food insecurity are many and are often rooted in issues of race and poverty, which the pandemic has just made worse. Finding sustenance or asking for aid is even more precarious for certain communities now. Marina Vergara and Kennedy Mitchell are organizers for LA Community Fridges. Hi, Marina. Hi, Kennedy.
Hello.
Hello.
So the minute I saw this story start to percolate on Instagram, I was immediately intrigued. So Marina, why don't you just describe the basics of what it is? What is a community fridge?
Like you mentioned, the lending libraries that folks have seen, you know, take a book, leave a book, that have popped up around the U.S. over the last 2 years. It's the same concept. So there's no policing of the community fridges. They're open to everyone to give and take and maintain. So it's a really, really nice community building idea that it offers an alternative to traditional methods of aid.
And what I wonder is, who approaches whom? Does an organization go to a potential location and say, would you mind plugging this in?
So there are many different scenarios. I think, you know, myself as both a host and an organizer, I had the location, but I've also worked with other businesses to help them get set up in front of coffee shops and markets. So it works both ways.
Tell me about your location.
So our first location is in a residential neighborhood in Mid-City. It is in front of a transitional housing facility that is run by an organization that I work with called Reach for the Top. And I thought this was a really great location because there's a lot of foot traffic. Over the past few months, we've noticed more and more people coming into our trash cans and looking for bottles and cans to recycle to add to their income. And I thought, you know, there's obviously a need here. We've been running a food distribution for many years, but I think this definitely pulls in more of the population and gives us a wider reach as to who is getting fresh food and vegetables.
So this is a refrigerator that's literally on the sidewalk in front of a business or a residence. Can just anybody come up and open the door and stand and stare in and take something?
Our goal is that we create and through the partnership with our host locations and the presence of volunteers at our fridge, our goal is to make the community fridges welcoming and inviting to everyone who needs it. If you are not in need at that time, feel free to stop by and drop off some surplus produce or canned goods or even a prepared meal that you're able to share.
I just wanted to stress that, you know, our community fridges that they offer an alternative to traditional methods of aid, which is so necessary right now, especially since so many people are out of work or their income has suffered because of COVID-19. You know, traditional food banks and food drives, they're not always held in residential neighborhoods, which really limits those who don't have access to reliable transportation. And also there's a lot of shame involved with going and standing in a line for what many consider a handout. Our fridges offer anonymity. They're not policed. You know, they're maintained and stocked by our community. And I think that that is, you know, really opening up new ways of accessing populations that have been left out.
Are donations welcome from anyone?
Yes, donations are welcome from anyone. And at this time, we haven't made the choice to accept monetary donations because we feel like this is an effort that calls on people to utilize what's already available to them. So we also, in an effort to remain transparent and not hoard any money unnecessarily, we're trying to be very intentional about that. And it's been a wonderful effort so far because of the way we've been able to really just express a need and have it met by our communities.
Have the two of you noticed what you need the most? Does it vary community to community? Is it prepared meals mostly you're looking for, sandwiches or fruit or water? And what about items that are non-perishable?
In my experience, prepared foods, whether that be a salad or a sandwich or, you know, a baked meal, those are the quickest to get picked up by our neighbors. We also have pantries at most of our fridge locations with fresh pasta and rice and other grains that go quite quickly as well. But we love, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables, and so does our community.
What about things like extra bottles of hand sanitizer or wipes, things for personal hygiene? If someone who is listening, for example, has an opportunity to donate a box of sanitizer or wipes, is that needed as well?
Absolutely. We've had masks donated, hand sanitizer, cleaning products, hygiene kits. We are welcoming any sort of assistance right now, any sort of donations, whether that be food, drink, or folks to stay healthy and hygienic during COVID-19.
How many community refrigerators are there throughout the city?
I believe Limerick Park does make 9 community fridges in the greater Los Angeles area. And we're also hoping to support our friends in Compton and different areas of Long Beach, I believe, and Bellflower to hopefully expand and help them start fridges in their community as well soon.
Is there some kind of map or list that people can go to know where there might be a fridge closest to them?
Yes. Our LA Community Fridge Instagram bio has a link to a Google map that will pull up all the maps in the LA area.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Marina Vergara and Kennedy Mitchell, organizers behind LA Community Fridges. I thought we could end the show with the story of apricots, how something so blissful and seemingly innocuous could become a proxy for deep-seated resentment and even war. Stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Geographical next-door neighbors have been fighting as long as they've been cooperating, since the beginning of time. One of the latest conflicts to break out is between Armenia and Azerbaijan in the Caucasus. And food, a symbol of nationhood and or identity, often becomes an additional lens for conflict. In this instance, it's all about the apricot. Armenian-American journalist Liana Agajanian wrote a piece about the apricot wars in the area for her blog, Dining in Diaspora. Hi, Liana. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm excellent. Describe the place of the apricot in Armenian culture.
Sure. So the apricot is considered a treasured national symbol. It is represented in everything from the flag. It's a tricolored flag, and the orange color is said to represent the apricot, to the wood, apricot wood being used in national instruments, and to more modern cultural phenomena like the film festival that Armenia has is called the Golden Apricot. And songs are written about the apricot. And one of them was actually entered into the Eurovision Song Contest in 2010. And it was called Apricot Stone, singing the praises of the fruit.
And what is the Latin name of the apricot?
Yes, the Latin name is Prunus armeniaca, which points to Armenia as its given origins. I believe the stones of the apricot were found in Armenian settlements that were thousands of years old. And so it's a fruit that's heavily tied to the land in which the Republic of Armenia sits on now. And the best apricots I've eaten have come from the region. And if you talk to Armenian diasporans across the world, they never forget that taste. It's kind of synonymous with being in Armenia. And unfortunately, because of the fragile nature of the fruit, they cannot be transported as they are to the U.S., but you can find a lot of jams and fruit leathers and dry fruits in the U.S. from Armenia.
This latest eruption of conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan coincided with the apricot harvest. Tell us about the harvest. How big is it?
It's quite large. It takes place in an area of Armenia known as the Araratian Valley. And it is a huge production with a lot of apricot trees. And the biggest place where Armenia exports its apricots is Russia.
So there's an export market as well as domestic.
Correct. Yes. There was a border crossing in between Russia and Georgia that opened in 2010, which led to a larger amount of exports going to Russia from Armenia.
Where do farmers usually sell the bulk of their fruit?
So from my understanding, they sell them to wholesalers and it gets distributed across to other smaller markets and restaurants or other supermarkets in the city. So the place where this apricot skirmish took place was at the largest, if not a very large, outdoor wholesale market in Russia.
And how many truckloads are we talking about?
We're talking about an estimated 50. So 50 truck drivers were carrying goods. In terms of tons, I'm not sure how many there were, but as you said, it's in the middle of the apricot harvest. And so these 50 trucks were just for one day, and apricots were coming in before these trucks and continued to come in after these trucks as well.
So what set off this fruit proxy war?
So the origins, to give a little context, came when Azerbaijani social media users uploaded videos of themselves buying Armenian apricots and then stomping on them, filmed it and put it on social media networks like TikTok and Twitter. That kind of went a little viral in those circles. And then this idea of the 50 truck drivers who were denied entry into the wholesale market happened a day after that. So all these trucks showed up, and the market managers basically told them that they weren't allowed to sell their apricots in the market.
And what happened? Was there a white knight who came to rescue all these apricots?
It was a very coordinated effort amongst the Armenian community there. They kind of spurred into action, both individually and organizers, as well as market owners of Armenian descent who opened up the land that they had for the truck drivers to come and sell their apricots. And so it was a community effort that kind of took hold and launched a very interesting channel on the social networking app called Telegram called Operation Apricot, where all the information was being shared and sale points were being coordinated. The Ministry of Economy in the Republic of Armenia was also involved.
So interesting. When did all this happen?
This happened over the weekend. So Saturday, Sunday, I believe, is when I first, or Friday, Saturday is when I first heard about this taking place. And I saw it through various social media posts, as well as Armenian language and Russian language newspapers that were posting about it.
So the places where the trucks were actually able to park and then throw open the back of the trucks to bring out apricots for people to buy, did sort of de facto little festivals spring up?
Yes, which is not surprising when you get a large group of Armenians together and you have fruit to celebrate with. It will usually devolve into some kind of party. But yes, so there were stalls set up to feed people who had come to stand in line for the apricots. Musicians showed up. People were also playing songs. They started dancing. And so it turned into this big apricot festival in the middle of these parking lots.
So interesting. Well, thank you so much. This was such an unusual story to just spring up. I'm glad we had you to tell us about it.
I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you. Thank you so much.
That was Liana Agajanian. Her blog is Dining in Diaspora. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Kenny Ng. If you're going out to eat, or even if you're ordering takeout, we are now in this for the long run. Pace yourself emotionally, and whether you stay in or you venture out, pull out your patience gene and be kind to the people in your bubble you're sick of and those who are allowing you to stay there by bringing you what you need. Yeah, I'm going to say it again. Remember to tip well. I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.